Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about the historic Drish House in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The Drish House in Tuscaloosa, Alabama is a former plantation built by Dr. John Drish and his wife Sarah in 1837. In 1867, tragedy struck when Dr. Drish unexpectedly passed away in the house, the result of a fatal fall down its steep staircase. His widow, Sarah, outlived him by 17 years, mourning his loss until her own demise in 1884. It's said that Sarah utilized ornate candles for John's funeral and kept them with the intention they would be used for her own funeral. It's said that when Sarah passed, the candles could not be found. The legend is that Sarah, fueled by fury over this oversight, continues to haunt the Drish House to this day. It's said that not long after Sarah's death, the local resident was alarmed to discover a fire burning in the front tower of the home. Firefighters were notified, but when they arrived, there was no sign of a fire. There are some people alive today who say they have also seen the flames in the tower. Some think it's Sarah's spirit lingering in the tower that set the space ablaze. Maybe she's angry or disappointed that her husband's candles had not been burned at her own funeral. Is there any truth behind that story? We'll talk about it in this episode of The Grave Talks with owners Matt and Nika McCool. How did the two of you end up buying the Drish House? I see Nika smiling, a very big smile.
I'm smiling because this is a fundamental question. We get this all the time, and we really don't have a good answer. So my answer is going to start with something that might interest you, which is the paranormal phenomena that surround the house. The Drish House, in my experience, attracts the things it needs. This is the strangest thing, and I've seen it over and over, that things we need will just show up at our door. And I think I put us in that same category. We had just finished a restoration project in Tuscaloosa, another home of similar age. And we were approached by the Tuscaloosa County Preservation Society about acquiring the Drish House. And it just drew us in. I don't have a better answer than that. And this really seems improbable looking back, doesn't it, Matt?
It does.
It does. We were there when everything was boarded up. It was the flashlight tour where there were lots of places upstairs you couldn't put your weight. And looking back, I think, oh my gosh, it's astonishing that we ended up with this house.
You know, I've talked to people who have said they really felt like the house or the property picked them.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like that?
Yeah, I really did. I still feel like that every day.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting. I talked to a couple recently, and they were going to sell their, it's a hotel kind of bed and breakfast, and they're going to sell it. And they basically said that the spirits there picked the people who they were going to sell it to. They really picked up on this really negative energy. And then this one couple, it was like they just knew that that's who they needed to sell it to. So I think mm-hmm. that's interesting how a place can pick you. So let's go way back with the Drish House. So Dr. John Drish built the house. It's old, like in 1837.
1837, correct.
Now, had he remarried by that point to Sarah? Because Sarah had some of her own money, right?
Yes,
from
she
a
did.
Previous marriage.
So, yes, he had. Dr. Drish came to Tuscaloosa in 1822 from Virginia, where his first wife had passed away, and he left a daughter, Catherine, in Virginia. She later joined him in Alabama and traveled to Tuscaloosa by boat. So he went to the coast of Virginia, the sea route down to Mobile, and then up the rivers to Tuscaloosa. This is as far as you can get by flatboat. After Tuscaloosa, you would have had to continue overland to the next settlement, which would have been Huntsville, Alabama, where Matt's from, and that would have been about another 2 weeks. So people were coming to Alabama from Virginia and Maryland and the Carolinas to buy the lands that the government had just taken by treaty from the Native American tribes and had opened up for auction. It was a chance to get cheap land on what was then the frontier.
By looking at this house, he had to have been pretty successful.
Because
I find it impressive by today's standards, looking at photographs of the home. But man, when you think about 1837, was there quite a bit of money in the Tuscaloosa area at that time? Was this house kind of like the house everyone marveled at? Because it's architecturally, it's stunning.
It is. It is architecturally quite unique because Dr. Drish was his own architect. He was a gentleman architect, among many other things. But Tuscaloosa was very prosperous in the 1830s and 40s. We were briefly the state capital. The university was founded here in 1831. It's hard by modern standards to describe the fortunes that could be made in cotton in Alabama and Mississippi at that time. There was a lot of money to be made. It was such an important commodity for the whole world.
And for someone like Dr. Drish, he was a slave owner. So in 1837, he had slaves, so he was able to build this house. Pick the cotton, maybe if he had some, because there's a lot of land that goes with his house at that time.
Yes. I mean, he was very much a man of his age. I've often thought that his life just really neatly encompasses what we think of as the Old South or the Cotton Kingdom. Mm-hmm. He was born in 1795. Before the invention of the cotton gin, and he died in 1867, just after the end of the Civil War. So that whole world existed pretty much just in John Drish's lifetime. He was a slaveholder. There were at the Drish House, which was then the centerpiece of a plantation called Monroe Place, generally something around 40 slaves. There were also 4 or 5 free people of color in each, the census of 1850 and 1860. I really don't know much about their stories, but I've always found that very intriguing that there was this like small group of free people of color who lived on Monroe Place and whom I would assume would have been the very skilled craftsmen among the building crew that John Drish sent out.
So Dr. Drish, living a pretty good life, he remarries to Sarah.
Right.
They live in the home together. His daughter ends up moving back in with him.
Yes.
And she had some mental health issues.
I think so. So Catherine Drish seems to have had a pretty normal and happy childhood and young girlhood. She was an only child, but she had a cousin, Helen, who came to the Drish House to live with her so that she would not grow up alone.
Oh, that's nice.
She married William Woodson King, who was a boy from New Orleans that was studying law at the University of Alabama. I don't find any credence in this sort of, she was forced into marriage or anything. They seem to have just been young people who fell in love and got married. But in 1840, she really had a couple of bad things happen. Her daughter, Cora, died. Cora was not quite 3 years old. She's buried here, very close to her grandparents. Cora is in the same section of the cemetery as them. And within 6 weeks, she gave birth to her third child, her son, Edmund. And I'm not sure that, you know, maybe what happened to Catherine isn't what we would now just call postpartum depression. I think to have lost a child and then bore a child that close together would be a lot of it would be a mental burden for anyone. It seems to have been too much for her. She was never quite the same after that.
You can't blame her, though. I mean, that would be so much. And, you know, then in the 1800s, it's not like you had help with mental health issues. You just...
Right. And I mean, she came back to live with her father, who was a physician, and her stepmother. And she stayed in the Drish house until Sarah's death in the 1880s. She stayed there the rest of her stepmother's life. And then her older son, who was also named John, came and got her. I'm not really sure. He lived in Mississippi, but I'm not really sure where.
Now, did Dr. Drish and Sarah, did they have a good, solid marriage?
They seem to have had a fairly happy marriage. Dr. Drish was actually sued in court in Alabama for seduction.
What?
And had to pay this young girl's family $1,525 in 19th century dollars for ruining her virtue. So I'm not sure if that was a one-time dalliance. It's the only one that there are court records. But they seem to have been fairly happily married for a long time.
So this court settlement, that didn't have anything to do with Sarah being young. And was this another girl that he had kind of a...
Yeah, that he had an affair with, and her family sued in court.
You don't even think about that these days. And
oh, yeah, you could do that in the 19th century.
And yeah.
It's a funny thing that it was $1,525.
Which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good settlement.
Pretty good settlement, yeah.
So let's say they had an okay marriage with an asterisk, because that couldn't have been easy for Sarah to deal with.
Well, they were married a long time, and by all accounts, they seemed to have.
So at some point, though, from what I've read... And that's why I love to talk to people who actually know, because sometimes I don't read the right things, you know, you find things that aren't true. But I read that he had some issues with alcohol in his later life.
The comments I would have about that, I don't have any evidence that John Drish drank or gambled more than other men in his social position in his day. Right.
Okay.
He was, like I said, very much a man of his own times, almost an exemplar of those times. And he was extremely successful. I know, of course, you can be a functioning alcoholic, but those two things don't go together for me. The thing that people bring up a lot is that late in his life, he may have turned to alcoholism. He rewrote his will within months of his death. To me, it has the air of someone settling their affairs who knew that they were in their last illness, because he was trying to rewrite his will, settle his remaining property, get everything lined up. In the 19th century, if you had had cancer or anything that caused a lot of pain, your options to treat that really would have been alcohol or laudanum. Either of which is very addictive. So, you know, I look upon that with a little more compassion, mm-hmm. I think, than most people.
And I think part of that, too, goes to the legend of what happened in that house and how much of that is really true.
Yeah, and we don't know.
And we'll get into some of the stories surrounding the hauntings and... You know, is he there? Is Sarah there? Fires in the, you know, it's like, there's so many questions about that, because I was reading the story about his death, and he was in the home and they lit some candles, and Sarah said, I want these candles when I die.
Right.
And they couldn't find the candles when she died, or maybe they didn't look, I'm not sure. But I can't imagine Sarah would hold that big of a grudge that she would still be haunting the place over some candles that they didn't.
They were candles that you couldn't find after. She lived another 17 years. So I always tell people, like, I can't find half the things I put down in my house last week, much less a candle that I put away 17 years ago.
And that's a big house. They probably had a lot of things in that house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of architecture is the house? It has this really stunning tower on the top of it that looks like that goes to, is that a third? Would you consider that like a third floor level?
I'm going to let Matt talk to that. He's been in the attic a lot more than I have.
Yeah. So the tower was built 20 years after the house was built. So in 1837, he built the house in a kind of in a Federalist style. Straight walls, very, very federalistic, and not a lot of amenities to it, I guess, or outside. So he was a builder. He built a lot at the university. He used the Drish House as a showcase. The house originally was built using materials from the plantation. It's 480 acres. They built a kiln and fired their own bricks. So it was really built in a unique style where it would support itself as it was being built. In the 1850s, he felt like he needed to renovate. There were some other houses being built in Tuscaloosa by some prominent businessmen. The Jemison Mansion is one that's within eyesight of where Monroe Place was. And so he decided to build and make it an Italianate style, and added the tower, which is a three-story tower. But in order to do that, he had to change the roof line. So he added a second roof to the front of it and extended it out and extended it with the two columns on either side of the tower at that time. So really changed the house dramatically. We call it an Italianate, is it Renaissance? Is that
mm-hmm.
Italianate Renaissance look? Like each, it had eight fireplaces in the original structure, four upstairs, four downstairs with four chimneys. And so each one of the fireplaces were different because he really did use the Drish House is a showcase in saying, well, you can come in and let me show you some examples of what we can build for you.
How many bedrooms does it have?
Originally, it was four bedrooms upstairs. It was eight rooms total. You had four rooms downstairs with a big hallway for cooling purposes, and then the same floor plan upstairs. And that's been totally changed over time. When the church bought it, they took out the massive walls and opened it up into assembly space downstairs. And then they also took out the main dividing walls upstairs, and they built Sunday school rooms around the perimeter of the house.
So in that tower that was added on, is that a functioning space, or was it more just decorative?
A little bit of both. You physically walk out of upstairs. You physically walk out of the house and enter the tower, and it's mm-hmm. all just another room, right? The big controversy is: was there a third floor, and where was it ever used? And we don't have evidence. We haven't seen any evidence that there was access to the third floor from mm-hmm. inside. And I know there's no access to the third floor of the tower from the attic. So mm-hmm. the house was totally different, had balconies all around the house on the second floor. So you could walk from the tower onto the balcony and then walk around the whole house if you wanted to at that time. Very ornate, a lot of ironwork. But unfortunately, all those features have been taken down over time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because so Sarah, as you said, went on to live there 18 more years after Dr. Drish died.
Yep.
And then after she passed away, it became, was it a school first?
It was a school. So after Sarah Drish passed away, it did go through a few more owners who lived there as a private home, including Judge Cochran, who's the protagonist, if you will, in the story in 13 Alabama Ghosts of Jeffrey. And the house really looked great when the Cochrans were living there. So in 1906, we got really good pictures of the house. The grounds were beautiful. The house itself was well kept. It looked wonderful. In 1910, it was sold to the city of Tuscaloosa and became the Jemison School. And the city stripped away the ornamental ironwork. They took out the elliptical staircase inside and put in a more sort of utilitarian staircase and just stripped a lot of things off of the house. So by the time the school moved out, the city leased the house to Tuscaloosa Wrecking Company and Auto Parts. So during the Depression, it was very famously an auto parts store and was photographed by Walker Evans when he came south to do the photographs for Now Let Us Praise Famous Men. He took photographs of the Drish House. And you can, it's a really stark contrast if you look at, you know, the photographs from 1906 and the photographs from 20 years later in 1936. The house had made a really steep decline in that period of time.
At some point, because then it was a church for a while.
Right, 1940, the church bought the house, and it was a church for like 450 years.
For 50 years. And then after that, this is what I found really interesting, because it seemed like relatively been taken decent care of. Maybe not so much during the wrecking company phase. It probably got a lot of wear and tear on it at that time.
Yeah, it looked pretty rough in 1940 when the church took it over. We have really good photographs, and it was looking pretty bad like that.
Yeah, pretty bad. It's one of my favorite photographs because it just shows how it ebbed and flowed with the times.
Mm-hmm.
But it made it all the way into the 1990s, I should say, since it goes through two different centuries. But it goes into the 1990s, and then it's scheduled to be demolished, as we were talking about, and they didn't have the money to demolish it.
The house, it had been empty for 25 years. I've talked to a lot of people who went to church at Southside Baptist, so their church home was the Drish House, and there's consensus that their congregation disbanded around 1990. You know, most of them now are elderly people, or they were children when they went to church there. So you got to make a little allowance for memories to be different. But I've heard everything from like 1987, 88 to 1990. So then the church moved out and the building was just left abandoned. It became bat infested. That caused a lot of damage. When we got the structure, there had been a lot of water damage. It was just left to deteriorate for 25 years.
So at what point did you step in there for the first time? Because if you bought it after it had been abandoned, obviously you went in it while it was abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So was it an investigation you were doing? Was it curiosity? Was it, I kind of feel drawn to this house?
We went at the invitation of the Preservation Society. So they had acquired the deed to the house when the church could not afford to have the house demolished and it had been condemned by the city. The Preservation Society threw them a lifeline and said, you know, if you'll just sign the house over to us, we will stabilize the structure enough to keep it from being condemned. So they had transferred ownership to the Preservation Society, who had indeed done that. They had stabilize the structure and put a new roof on. But they really didn't have the funding to do any more. And so they really hadn't done anything else. They were using it for storage. There was a lot of stuff in the house.
It looked like a hoarder lived there.
Oh.
You had a little pass.
Oh.
And so you had a bunch of wood floors, a bunch of big old doors.
Just stuff.
And it looked really, really haunted at that point.
Oh, yeah. Really haunted. And it was pink. It was bright pink.
All the windows were boarded up.
Right. So it's pitch dark inside. And there were no ceilings because the bats had damaged the ceiling so much, they had torn all the ceilings out. So every space you were in, you were sort of looking at the floor decking above you. And that's odd.
It's yeah. So here you are in this house that needs a ton of work. And the two of you are like, we think we're the people for this. We want to do this.
We weren't thinking very clearly.
Was it something though that you had discussed and thought about for a little bit and kind of, I mean, Matt, with your background, you know, you probably looked at things differently and were like, man, fixing this is going to be a lot.
Well, I'd say one thing, it was something we were passionate about. And the other thing is we just had a very successful project where we finished a house. Not in that bad of a shape, but Tuscaloosa is where we got four sons, and our oldest boy was a sophomore, about to be a junior, and our next boy was coming in to live there. So we bought an old house, redid it, and it was an apartment for all four of our sons to live there for 10 years of time and go to school here. And that one worked out really well. And we're kind of coming off the high of finishing that bucket. And then we saw this one, and I guess we knew in the back of our minds, if somebody didn't take it over, it probably would be condemned. You know, we didn't have any preconceived notions of what we wanted to do with it or exactly how the project would go. And it was a massive undertaking for us.
Oh my gosh. And looking at the pictures on your website of what it looks like today, it just, like, you have these beautiful weddings that happen there and events that happen there. It's just, it's quite amazing talking to you what it was to what it is.
Yeah,
how long was that process? I'm assuming, well, number one, if it's built in 1837, you're never caught up. It's probably an ongoing process all the time.
Yep. We're having work done on it this week.
Funny you should ask.
Did it take several years to get it to a point where you could host events there and do things with the property?
As Nika said, it took 2 years from when we started to when we finished the construction and got our certificate of occupancy so we could open the business. It didn't take that long with just the work that we did. It took that long for us to, first we did the exterior and got it watertight and got it looking good. And it was no longer pink. But then we took about a year just to decide what were we going to do with it. And we went from commercial office space to trying to rent it out to, you know, Mercedes as a home office here in Tuscaloosa because they've got a big manufacturing plant pretty close to Tuscaloosa. And we finally settled on an event venue. And that's when we drove hard to finish the inside and get it all done. It's been 10 years of continual work because we ran out of money because you never have enough money.
We never have enough money. And almost 200-year-old house.
And there was, so it, over the last 10 years, we pick up the pieces that we wanted to do, but just didn't have the resources at the time and trying our best to preserve it and be true to the house while making it look good and functional. Nika has an idea that all old homes can't be museums. They can't all be just for rich people to live in. You gotta have other uses for them and invite other people to it. And that's probably what's kind of unique is when we have an event, whether it be a wedding or a sorority formal or whatever, we open up the whole house and invite everybody to tour it and see everything. Yeah. And people are constantly amazed. Well, aren't you worried about damage or things walking off? And we just show them the pictures of the house from 1940. And I don't think at the end of this party it's going to look like this.
This is where we started.
We had 274 seventh graders week before last come through the house. So, you know, we want the Drish House to be a vibrant part of the community. And it really is a special place. And we want people to come there and create their own memories and enjoy their time in the Drish House.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation about the historic Drish House. You can get more information about events, weddings, and paranormal investigations at their website, historicdrishhouse.com, or search for them on Facebook, Historic Drish House. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, get everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. You can sign up on Apple Podcasts, where you can try it for 3 days free. You can also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. Everything is all there, all commercial free. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.